Now, in the first service, I began by asking whether anyone had done jury service to put their hand up or give me a nod or whatever. And surprisingly, there were very few. I don't know whether anyone here has done jury service. Have we got one or two around? Yeah. I'll be interested to know how you found that. No one's doing it at the moment, are they? We can't ask you what's going on, can we? That'd be fun. If you haven't done jury service, I wonder whether you would like to. Or whether you would find that a fascinating, interesting experience. I've never done jury service, but for a few hours last September, just for the experience, I did go down to London and to the Old Bailey. You can just turn up and you can go and sit in one of the public galleries in one of the courtrooms and you can watch the proceedings of a case. And there were seven cases that day. Five of them were related to murder. So in court five, the one I sat in on, the victim had been stabbed in East London in 2017. In court six, a couple were on trial for the death of their three-month-old baby. In court seven was the trial of someone accused of a stabbing in Westminster. In court 10, there was a case about a 21-year-old who had been shot in the chest in Battersea. And then in court 16, an 18-year-old girl was charged with murder for the murder of a 51-year-old man. And as I sat in the public gallery in court five, watching the prosecution lay out their case against the accused in incredible detail, I just found a tiny but fascinating insight into the legal system in the UK. Well, what about the legal system of Old Testament Israel under the Old Covenant? How did that function? As James has reminded us, God, having saved Israel from Egypt, he's brought them to Mount Sinai, and he's making a covenant with them. And as part of that covenant, he's given to them the 10 laws that he wants them to keep, the 10 commandments. And he did that in chapter 20, verses 1 to 21. And of course, these 10 commandments, they're summed up in the two great commandments: to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And then God gave the people of Israel the Book of the Covenant, which is what we're looking at the moment. What is the Book of the Covenant? Well, the Book of the Covenant explains how the Ten Commandments were to be put into practice in everyday life of Israel under the Old Covenant. And it did this by presenting lots of case laws and everyday scenarios so that if a certain type of situation arose, Israel would know what to do and how to apply the law in that situation. And thereby, it provided a framework for civil law in Israelite society. Now, we, of course, we don't live in Israel. We're not under Israel's civil law, and we're not under the Old Covenant. We live in the UK. We're under the UK law, and we are under the New Covenant. But still, as we go through the Book of the Covenant, we still see the principles that are behind what God said, and we can learn from them and live our lives wanting to please the Lord. Now, we're looking at chapter 21 and verses 12 to 36. And the commandment that this passage is especially applying is the sixth commandment, which is, you shall not murder. You shall not murder. There are other commands in the background too, but it's the sixth commandment, you shall not murder, which is in the foreground. Now, you will notice as we read and go through the passage that there is a progression in the passage that we've had read for us. So it starts with the most serious cases and the severest of penalties, and then it moves to cases which are where the penalty is less severe. And as we look at the passage, there will be principles that I want to draw out along the way. So we're going to start by looking at verses 12 to 17. And we see here offences that result in the death penalty. Offences that result in the death penalty. And the passage starts with the most straightforward case, serious case. Verse 12, whoever strikes a person so that they die shall be put to death. Whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. Under the old covenant in Israel, if someone murdered someone, they were to be put to death. This execution wasn't to be carried out randomly. No, it had to happen within a community setting. A proper process of justice had to be followed. For someone to be found guilty, there had to be witnesses who could establish the facts. It had to be clearly proved that the person was guilty of the crime. In Deuteronomy 17, it says that no one was allowed to be put to death on the basis of one witness. There had to be at least two witnesses to the murder. So that's the basic principle. If someone murders, if someone breaks the sixth commandment, they were to be put to death. They were to be executed. Now, that, of course, opens up a whole load of other questions. So, for example, what if the guilty party hadn't planned to kill the person? What if it had just happened in the heat of the moment, an argument blew up and it happened? What if it wasn't premeditated? What if it was actually an accident? Well, that's dealt with in verse 13. If the killing wasn't premeditated, then the life of the person responsible wasn't required. And God provided a place of safety, a refuge that the person could go to receive protection from the victim's family. If, however, verse 14, it was premeditated, if the guilty party had plotted and schemed and put together this plan to kill this person, then they were not allowed to find safety in a city of refuge. There were some situations where someone could pay a ransom to escape a death penalty. You'll see that in verse 30, but not with premeditated intentional murder. If someone has killed someone else on purpose, if they schemed it and they've plotted it, if they've planned it, their life has to be ended. And this highlights our first principle, and that is the value of human life. The value of human life. We live in a society where human life is being valued less and less. And yet here we see how much God values human life. God values human life so much that if one person deliberately takes the life of another person, their life should also be taken. This law of capital punishment, it's not a breaking of the sixth commandment, but rather a recognizing of the seriousness of the sixth commandment. And it finds its roots not in the old covenant, but way back before the old covenant in what God told Noah after the flood in Genesis 9. You remember how there was so much violence on the earth and God was grieved by the violence, and so God came and he judged humanity. He decreated through the flood, and then he recreated by using Noah and the family and the animals in the ark. He recreated the earth in that way. And having been so grieved by the violence that he had seen on the earth in this new start, God said, "For your lifeblood, Noah, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal and from each human being too. I will demand an accounting for the life of another human being. Whoever sheds human blood, by human shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made mankind." So taking the life of one of God's image bearers is so serious that God says that the guilty person's life should be taken as well. Which confronts us with the question, what are your thoughts on capital punishment today? What are your thoughts on capital punishment today? It forces you to think about that question. Christians are divided. I imagine we will be this morning. Christians are divided. Some oppose it. They emphasize the need for mercy. The gospel age that we are living in. The fallibility of our courtrooms. Other Christians, however, hold to the opposite belief. And they emphasized the fact that capital punishment was instituted by God before the Old Covenant, that it's not limited to the Old Covenant. And they would point out in Romans 13, where Paul refers to the sword in the hand of the civil authority, clearly pointing to the authority that the rulers had to execute people in punishment for crimes. Paul seems to suggest that it continues into the New Testament. And so the question for you is what do you think? Have you grappled with it? What do I think? It's tempting not to tell you. It's such a difficult, difficult issue. But for me personally, I think that what God told Noah still applies. I think that human life is so valuable, and that being an image bearer is so significant, and that there are some premeditated murders which are so heinous that where a person's guilt can be clearly proved beyond doubt, there are times where capital punishment biblically can be an option for a civil authority. That's something for you to think about over lunch. Let's move on. In verses 15 to 17, here you have crimes where no physical human life has been taken, and yet the punishment is still the death penalty. And in verses 15 and 17, the fifth commandment is also in view. So in verse 15, someone has attempted to kill their mum or their dad. The parent survives, but the law says the punishment is still death. In verse 17, someone has cursed their parents. Now, this is not a mild argument as they eat cornflakes over the breakfast table. No, this is someone treating one of their parents with utter contempt. And again, the punishment is death. Do I think that this punishment should apply today? No, I don't. Why? Well, it was clearly for Israelite society under the Old Covenant, and it's clearly not carried through into the New Testament. But see a second principle, how highly God values parents. How highly God values parents. See how respectful children are to be to their parents. Children are to value their parents and to hold them in the highest esteem. Family life was to be one of the great bedrocks of Israelite society. And if someone was willing to treat their parents like this, if someone was willing to try and murder one of their parents, then they were a threat to everyone in society. And in all these scenarios in verses 12 to 17, the protection of society is very much in view. In verse 16, if someone was found guilty of human trafficking or forcing someone into slavery, they were to be put to death. Why? Well, because though their victim was still physically alive, in essence, they've had their life snatched away. And so, having pressed upon you again the value of human life, and the value that God puts on human life. Humans are not objects to be done with whatever you want to or to be disposed of as you will. Human beings are made in the image of God, and they are precious, and they have worth and dignity. Have impressed upon you the value of human life. Our next section is verse 18 to 27. And this is all about personal injury. Personal injury. And again, the different scenarios continue. So have a look at verses 18 and 19. So here, two men have got into an argument. Maybe they were riding their donkeys in the opposite direction and they had a near miss. And they've stopped and confronted each other, and it's turned into an Old Testament example of road rage. At first it was verbal, but then it turns nasty. And in the heat of the moment, one lashes out with his fist, or the other picks up a rock and hits the other person with it. Now, if the person dies, we know what should happen, don't we? It's not premeditated, it's happened in the heat of the moment, and so the person who killed the other person should run to a city of refuge, verse 13. In this situation, however, the person survives. They don't die, but they are injured and they can't work for a period of time. In this situation, the person who hit him, he's clear regarding the sixth commandment. He's not guilty. No one's died. But he is held responsible for the loss of earnings, the period of time that this person can't work. And he is held responsible for his medical bills. And this introduces another principle, and that is taking responsibility for your actions. This will come up again and again in these different scenarios. What we do affects people. What I do, what you do, it affects other people. And we need to take responsibility for the things that we do. Let's move on. And let's take verses 20 and 21 together with verses 26 and 27. Now, clearly, use of a rod in the discipline of slaves was accepted in Old Testament Israel. So, for example, if you had an adult man who had sold his labor to you, but then who refused to do what you asked him to, use of the rod was seen as being a legitimate way to encourage him to work. However, the master was not to use excessive force. And if excessive force was used, verse 20, and the slave died, society had to hold that master to account and he would be punished. If the slave doesn't die, verse 21, the master is not punished. However, verses 26 and 27, if the slave sustains a serious injury, then the slave is no longer obligated to work for the master. They are free to go. And this introduces another principle, and that is the equality of people. The equality of people. In the ancient world, you were allowed to do whatever you liked to those who society deemed were less valuable than others. And so, for example, in pagan countries, masters, they could do whatever they liked with their slaves, and there were no consequences for them. They could beat their slaves to death, and nobody really cared. But in Israel, that was not to be the case. No, all human beings were to be seen as being made in the image of God and to be treated with dignity and respect and valued as much as you would value anyone else. And so if a master mistreated a slave, that master had to be held accountable for it. Israel was to be different. They were to be a light to the nations. We then have a situation in verses 22 to 25 where two men are fighting. And somehow a woman who is pregnant gets caught up in the melee and is hit by one of the men, and she gives birth prematurely. What do you do in that situation? Well, if neither mother or child are harmed, the consequence for the man who hit her is that he is to be fined. The amount of the fine is to be set by the husband, and the fine is to be reviewed by the judges to ensure that it's not more than it should be. If, however, the mother or child are harmed, then whatever injury they suffer, the person who caused it should be made to suffer it as well. And here's where we get those famous words, verse 23, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. And this introduces another principle, and that is proportionate punishment. And what's known as the law of retaliation or the law of equivalences. Now, this was given by God not to encourage retaliation, but to protect people from disproportionate responses. It was to restrict punishment. In essence, the punishment should fit the crime. If someone is going to be punished, then it should be fair. It shouldn't be excessive. And notice the value that is put on not just the life of the mother, but also on the life of the child. The unborn child was to be seen as being as valuable as the mother. And so we come to our third section, verses 28 to 36. And this section, you will notice, focuses on dangerous property. Dangerous property. Israelite society was mostly a farming community. Lots of farmers. People would invest money in their animals. You would have oxes. You would have bulls. And of course, what should happen? Verse 28. If your ox gores someone and kills them. So let's personalize this. Let's call the ox Rory. What should happen if Rory gets out of control and kills someone? Well, Rory is to be put to death. He is a danger to God's image bearers. We learned that back in Genesis 9. However, you as the owner of Rory are not to be put to death. It's just a tragic accident. Sometimes these things happen. If, however, verse 29, Rory the ox has a history of harming people, and you have been warned about Rory, and yet you've done nothing about it, and you haven't ensured that Rory is kept locked up in his pen, then not only is Rory to be put to death, but you are to be put to death as well. You knew that Rory was dangerous. You knew that Rory could harm people or even kill people, and yet you acted carelessly. Now, in this situation, verse 30, if the family say that a ransom could be paid, you can pay the ransom and escape death. Now, hands up who's got an ox. As I thought. So how does this apply to us? What property do you have that could harm someone or kill someone? I suspect a good number of us have cars. That would be one example. I suspect a good number of us drive. Your car is a machine that could hurt someone or kill them. It's lethal. How do you drive your car? Do you drive your car responsibly or carelessly? Do you drive your car with love for your neighbor or just only thinking about yourself? It gives us another principle. We have a responsibility not just for our actions, but also for our property. Let's get back to the text and continue with Rory, verse 31. If the ox gores a man's son or daughter, he shall be dealt with according to this same law. Now, in the ancient world, if an ox killed your son, what would normally happen is you would retaliate by killing the son of the person who owns the ox. So you wouldn't kill the owner of the ox, you would kill the son of the owner. But God is saying here, that should not happen. If an ox kills your son, it should be the owner of the ox who is held responsible and made to pay. And here is another principle. Guilt is not transferable. Guilt is not transferable. It's the person who is responsible who should be held to account and not the innocent party. Which goes against the grain of some loud voices in our society which say that whole groups of people, even whole generations of people, should be held responsible for things that they haven't done wrong. Guilt is not transferable. It's not transferable. Verse 32. If the ox gores a slave and presumably kills them, then the owner has to pay 30 shekels, that's a weight in silver, to the slave's master. The ox would be stoned, and verses 28 to 30 would apply. And then at the end of this section, in verses 33 to 36, you have scenarios where it's not a person that your property has killed or harmed, it's damage to the other person's property. So in verses 33 and 34, you've dug a great big pit, and then you've just gone off and left it. You don't cover it up, you've gone off and left it. Now, down the road lives Mrs. Wainwright, your neighbour. And Mrs. Wainwright has a donkey. We're going to call him Dylan. Dylan the donkey. And Dylan the donkey, he comes down the road, and he's already looking pretty sad. But Dylan the donkey, he comes down the road. He doesn't see the hole, and he falls into it. And poor old Dylan, he breaks his legs, and he dies. What should happen in that situation? Well, the person who dug the hole should pay Mrs. Wainwright however much Dylan was worth when he was alive. And he gets to keep the body of poor old Dylan. What about verses 35 and 36? What if Rory the ox headbutts another ox and that ox dies? What should happen then? Well, in that case, Rory has to be sold. And the two owners, you share the money that you get for Rory, and then you share the body of the dead ox. If, however, Rory had a history of harming other animals, and you didn't keep him secure, you have to pay the owner of the dead ox its value when it was alive, and you get to keep the dead ox. Again, underlying the principle that we are responsible, not just for our actions, but also for our property. Let me finish by applying this in three ways. Firstly, as we see the seriousness with which God takes murder, verse 12, how if someone murders someone else and it was premeditated, it was planned, it was schemed, it was thought through in their minds, how that guilty person should face the death penalty. As we see the seriousness with which God takes murder, remember what Jesus said in Matthew 5. Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder.' And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment." You see how Jesus, as he teaches on the Sermon on the Mount, he moves from not physical actions, but to the heart as well. So this morning, we may not be guilty of physical murder, but the challenge for us is not just about whether we've physically murdered someone, but what about murder in the heart? Have you murdered in your heart? Are you going through a period of your life where you are murdering someone? A character assassinating them? Wishing that they were no longer around. Thoughts of murder against them. Maybe they've really hurt you or harmed you, and they've done such damage to you, but your anger has turned into an ungodly anger, and it's poisonous and bitter, and it's turned into hatred. Well, see how seriously God takes that. You think of what John says in 1 John 3. He says, "We know that we have passed from death to life because we love each other. Anyone who does not love remains in death. Anyone who hates a brother or sister is a murderer. And you know that no murderer has eternal life residing in him." If that's a situation that you find yourself in this morning, I'm so sorry if you've been really hurt. But take these verses seriously. You're in a very dangerous place if this is you, a very dangerous place. And I urge you to talk to someone about it and not allow it go on. more importantly, bring it to the Lord. Bring it to the Lord who knows your situation. And find healing in his sight. Secondly, remember what else Jesus says in Matthew 5. You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. Now, when Jesus said that, Jesus wasn't saying that justice should no longer be applied in community settings. He wasn't saying there's no need anymore for law courts or judges or witnesses. Just forgive everyone. No, Jesus wasn't saying that. There are some things that need to be dealt with. There are some things that need to be brought into the light. What Jesus was saying, however, was from a personal perspective. From a personal perspective, in your personal relationships, you don't always have to ensure that punishment is exacted. In the context that the eye for an eye principle was given, it was not given to ensure that punishment always happened right up to the very maximum that could be applied, but rather to ensure that if punishment did take place, it was fair. And from a personal perspective, you can turn the other cheek. You don't have to pursue justice. You can show mercy. You can show compassion. Indeed, from a personal perspective, if you want to imitate God, that's the heart that you should have, because that's the heart that God has shown to you. God has turned the other cheek for you. God has shown such mercy to you. And then thirdly, in verse 31, we saw that guilt is not transferable. Guilt is not transferable. You cannot punish someone for someone else's sin. And yet here, as we find ourselves this morning, and as we find the law exposing the sin in each of our hearts, all those times where we have hated people, assassinated people in our hearts, wanted them to be gone. Thanks be to God that our guilt can be transferred onto Jesus, who willingly took it upon himself that we might go free. What a Savior we have. All of us are guilty this morning. None of us are righteous. And yet God in his grace has turned the other cheek. And he has had compassion on us. Let's just have a few moments of quiet and thought. And then we'll sing our final song.